Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is For the Record program number 319, titled Bush League Part 3. And what I'm going to be dealing with, as the title indicates, is some of the acts so far and some of the political associations of George Bush. We're going to begin, oh, by the way, this is being recorded on August 12th of the year 2001. We're going to begin by taking a look at a story that appeared on the front page of the Sunday edition of the New York Times on July 15th of the year 2001. The story has had a fair amount of publicity, but not nearly as much as it deserves, and this concerns the manipulation and the illegality involved in that manipulation of the absentee ballots in Florida, specifically the military absentee ballots. Recall that during the recount in the 2000 election, Al Gore was accused of being prejudiced against the military, etc., etc. This by the campaign of somebody who dodged the draft to avoid service in the Vietnam War, accusing someone who volunteered for duty in the Army in the Vietnam War, despite the fact that he was opposed to the war himself. The irony in that regard should not be lost. Among the stories that reprinted at least part of the New York Times article was the San Jose Mercury News for Sunday, July 15th of the year 2001, and I'm going to read part of that to you right now. The Mercury News titled this story, Absentee Ballot Push Gave Bush Key Edge. It's by David Barstow and Don Van Natta Jr. of the New York Times, and as I said, it reads in part as follows. On the morning after Election Day, George W. Bush held a lead of 1,784 votes in Florida, but to his campaign strategists, the margin felt perilously slim. They were right. Within a week, recounts would erode Bush's unofficial lead to just 300 votes. With the presidency hanging on the outcome in Florida, the Bush team quickly grasped that their best hope of victory was the ballots still arriving from Florida voters living abroad. Over the next 18 days, the Republicans mounted a legal and public relations campaign to persuade canvassing boards in Bush strongholds to waive the state's election laws when counting those ballots. Their goal was simple: to count the maximum number of overseas ballots in counties won by Bush, particularly those with a high concentration of military voters, while seeking to disqualify overseas ballots in counties won by Vice President Al Gore. A six-month investigation by the New York Times of this chapter in the closest U.S. presidential election shows that the Republican effort had a major impact. Under pressure from Republicans, Florida officials accepted hundreds of overseas absentee ballots that failed to comply with state election laws. In an analysis of the 2,490 ballots from Americans living abroad that were counted as legal votes after Election Day, the Times found 680 questionable votes. Although it is not known for whom the flawed ballots were cast, four out of five were accepted in counties carried by Bush, the Times found. Bush's final margin was 537 votes. The flawed votes included ballots without postmarks, ballots postmarked after the election, ballots without witness signatures, ballots mailed from within the United States, and even ballots from people who voted twice. All would have been disqualified had the election laws been strictly enforced. The Republican push on absentee ballots became an effective counterweight to the Gore campaign's push for manual recounts in mainly Democratic counties in southern Florida. The Times found that these overseas ballots, the only votes that could legally be received and counted after Election Day, were judged by different standards depending on where they were counted. The unequal treatment is at odds with statements by Bush campaign leaders and by Florida Secretary of State Katherine Harris that rules should be applied uniformly and not changed in the middle of a contested election. It also apparently conflicts with the equal protection guarantee the U.S. Supreme Court invoked in December when it halted a statewide manual recount and effectively handed Florida to Bush. I would note, too, that there was active interference in that particular case by a seated U.S. representative, a Republican representative, in the House of Representatives. There has been a fair amount of publicity recently about Katherine Harris, Florida's Secretary of State and the co-chair of the Bush for President campaign in that state. There has been a fair amount of publicity about her supposed disingenuousness in turning over computer records of some of the doings of the Secretary of State, and at least the press coverage that I saw in print on the West Coast basically maintained that she was playing above, basically playing it straight, so to speak, and that she was, again, disingenuously handing over the unpurged records. That would not appear to be accurate, at least as far as the computers, the election computers for Palm Beach County. Research credit on the following goes to a member of the listening audience who got this from the Chicago Tribune. And specifically, this was authored by Jeff Doherty, D-O-U-G-H-E-R-T-Y, of the Chicago Tribune. It's dated August 1st of 2001, and it's headlined, Files Erased in Florida, Damaging Election Review. The article can be accessed at the Chicago Tribune website at www.chicagotribuneoneword.com, /templates/miscellaneous/print story. And again, this is from August 1st of the year 2001. The article reads in part as follows. 5 months ago, election officials in Palm Beach County, Florida, turned their attention from last year's controversial presidential balloting to the spring election for dozens of municipal offices. As they prepared for the new election, they wiped out computer files showing how each ballot was punched in the presidential election, removing that information from the public domain, even as scholars and journalists continue to analyze the results of Florida's presidential voting. The data is especially important because Palm Beach was one of the key counties in the 5-week recount process that ultimately sent President Bush to the White House. The files were the only computerized record of the way the country's tabulating machines registered each ballot last November. The punch card ballots themselves were not destroyed but cannot be accurately recounted because they have been extensively handled and possibly damaged since Election Day. The erasure is an unexpected blow to advocates of election reform because of the data's historical value. By wiping out the records, the election staff also may have violated Florida's strict rules against destroying public records. Quote, whether or not it's in violation of the law is sort of irrelevant, unquote, said Allison Steele, a St. Petersburg, Florida lawyer who specializes in media issues. Again quoting, this is terribly foolhardy. This was certainly the closest election in modern history. It's important for historians to study it, and for us to study it and find out what went wrong, unquote. The missing files came to light when the Tribune filed a request for copies of them. Media organizations and academics have used the files to examine voter behavior, including the impact of the so-called butterfly ballot that may have led some voters to mistakenly select Pat Buchanan instead of Democratic nominee Al Gore. Palm Beach County also had an unusually high rate of spoiled ballots in the election. Gore won the county by 116,000 votes. Democrats had hoped the recount there and in a few other Democratic counties with widespread voting problems would have turned up enough votes for Gore to give him the state and the presidency. And I would note that there were numerous other irregularities, of course, with regard to the Florida election. A great many African-American voters were disqualified as being convicted felons. And in fact, the study that tabulated many of them or identified many of them as convicted felons was completely off. And many people who were many African-American voters in Florida who were absolutely qualified to cast a vote for president were disqualified on the basis of this fallacious study. There also, of course, was the question of misplaced ballots and people who were unable to. There was the famous butterfly ballot, and there also was the behavior of the media in connection with this. All in all, the leaving aside the behavior of the Supreme Court, the available weight of evidence suggests overwhelmingly that George Bush did not win the state of Florida, but rather Florida was, as they say in the world of statistics and social science, crunched. One of the aspects of the 2000 election campaign that I've dealt with at considerable length in the past concerned the behavior of the media, and specifically Fox News, which switched the call of Florida from Gore to Bush, thereby leading a media stampede. The head of the political desk at Fox News was John Ellis, the first cousin of George W., and Jeb, and it was Fox News that led the media charge, at least on television, with regard to switching the call of Florida from Gore to Bush. It would appear, first of all, that not only was that primary role of Fox News not at all unique, but that indeed the historical records concerning the media's role in the 2000 election, what I call the electoral coup of the year 2000, the available evidence would suggest that the behavior of the Fox network was by no means unique. And again, there it would also appear that the record is being deliberately obfuscated with regard to the behavior of some media voices, and one of those media voices is the NBC network. The Los Angeles Times, among other media voices, did carry some discussion of this, and the behavior of the National Broadcasting Corporation on election night has been the focal point of an investigation by Representative Henry A. Waxman of Los Angeles, and to a certain extent he's being stonewalled in his efforts to get to the bottom of just what exactly NBC was doing on election night. This is from the Los Angeles Times of Wednesday, August 8th of the year 2001. It's by Megan Garvey at State Washington and headlined, NBC balks at sharing election night tapes. This article reads in part as follows. A showdown between a Democratic congressman and the head of NBC over what exactly happened in the network's newsroom on election night is reviving questions about whether Congress should have any role in overseeing the news media. What began as a friendly offer by NBC President Andrew Lack at a Valentine's Day congressional hearing quickly degenerated into an exchange of angry letters between Lack and Representative Henry A. Waxman, Democrat of Los Angeles, over access to internal videotapes of NBC's newsroom on election night. While some observers said they doubted Waxman, who was threatened to seek a subpoena if the tapes aren't turned over by Labor Day, could force NBC to turn over any tapes, they said the dispute highlighted the pitfalls for executives from First Amendment-protected industries who voluntarily appear in front of Congress. At issue in Lack's case is sworn testimony at the February hearing and debauched election night news coverage. In his testimony, Lack offered to turn over a copy of tapes if they existed that showed the newsroom actions of his corporate boss, General Electric Chairman Jack Welch. The rumor, Waxman told Lack, was that Welch, a major contributor to the Republican Party, had, quote, intervened, unquote, in the network's decision to call the race for George W. Bush. Waxman said he had heard Welch, quote, cheered, unquote, for Bush and, quote, hissed, unquote, Democratic candidate Al Gore. At one point, Waxman said Welch had allegedly asked someone on the decision desk, what would I have to give you to call the race for Bush, unquote. Lack, speaking under oath, said that Welch was in the newsroom on election night to observe, adding that rumors the GE chairman did more were, quote, untrue and rather foolish, unquote. Lack also told Waxman he was, quote, certainly welcome to the tape, unquote. A week later, however, he argued that Congress had no right to the internal deliberations of any news organization. Moreover, he said in a letter to Waxman, pursuit of the footage violated the committee's assurances that, quote, there would be no attempt by Congress to insert itself in any form into our editorial processes, unquote. By July 31st, Lack said that as far as NBC was concerned, the issue was closed, a stance Waxman labeled, quote, arrogant, unquote. One wonders why the change of heart on the part of NBC President Andrew Lack, who at one point volunteered to turn the tape over to Mr. Waxman, and then for reasons he was apparently unwilling to disclose, which I don't think are particularly difficult to discern, he reversed his decision in that regard. It'll be interesting to see just what exactly comes of this. I would note, however, that if the shoe were on the other foot, if this had been someone who had been pushing for Al Gore, it would be interesting to hear the political talk shows, the AM radio talk shows, going to town on this. Likewise, the behavior of Dick Cheney in refusing to turn over records on the Energy Task Force is also more than a little interesting, and to me, one of the most disturbing aspects of this particular story is the relative lack of media coverage. Now, again, just suppose that Bill Clinton were the president and that it was Clinton's administration that was behaving in the following manner. This is from the New York Times of Saturday, August 4th of the year 2001, and I would note that this article, most newspapers haven't covered this story at all, at least of the papers that I read, most newspapers haven't covered this story at all, and the New York Times stuck it on page A 26. Obviously, that's pretty far back in the paper, and it's not something that's likely to catch most listeners or most readers' eyes. Now, again, just for purposes of imagination, suppose the shoe were on the other foot. Suppose this was Al Gore, who had chaired the Energy Task Force and was refusing to turn over documents to a congressional investigation. Can you imagine the firestorm you'd be hearing on AM talk radio? Again, the New York Times of 8/4/2001. This is a Reuters story, datelined Washington, headlined, Cheney refuses to release meeting records. It reads in part as follows. Vice President Dick Cheney declined today to turn over documents sought by Congress in an inquiry into how the Bush administration's energy policy was formed. In letters to the House of Representatives and the Senate, Mr. Cheney said that the request for meeting records of President Bush's energy task force, which was headed by the vice president, quote, would unconstitutionally interfere with the functioning of the executive branch, unquote. An aide to Representative Henry A. Waxman, a California Democrat and one of the lawmakers who originally requested the information, said Mr. Cheney appeared to be heading for a legal showdown. A senior aide to Mr. Cheney said that the vice president's office had already provided, quote, substantial information, unquote, and that the task force had acted properly. The task force has been criticized for its closed-door meetings and meetings with industry officials as it developed the energy policy Mr. Bush unveiled on May 17th. Mr. Bush called for stimulating production of coal, oil, and nuclear power, as well as conservation measures. And I would add that the conservation measures were far down on the list. Mr. Cheney's office said the letters were delivered to Congress on Thursday night, ahead of an August 7th deadline for a response, and the same day the House of Representatives approved legislation embodying major elements of the energy plan that the task force developed. Now, again, suppose the shoe were on the other foot. There would probably be calls for a special prosecutor already, and it would be refreshing to see the media dealing even-handedly with the Republican and Democratic administrations, but that does not appear to be something that is a realistic prospect offhand. One WAG noted that, quote, freedom of press only exists if you own one, unquote. In For the Record program number 315, titled Not So Fortunate Son, dealing with the work of the late J.H. Hatfield, the author of an unauthorized biography of George W. Bush called Fortunate Son, this was a book that was very critical of George W. Bush, and it made a number of allegations, the most publicized of which was discussion that George Bush had been arrested for cocaine use and had been obliged to do community service. That was the allegation from Fortunate Son that received the most publicity. I have used a copy. I've used the book in the past, specifically the original hardbound edition, which was then withdrawn from sale. And what I have used the book in connection with is the fact that one James R. Bath, allegedly a CIA officer, and in that capacity allegedly having been recruited by the elder George Bush, and who was certainly an investor in Arbusto Energy, George W.'s first energy company, and also the Texas business representative for the Bin Laden family, a wealthy Saudi-based construction, a family whose main source of wealth is a Saudi-based construction firm whose patriarch, Mohammed bin Laden, was very close to King Ibn Saud. And, of course, Osama bin Laden is probably the best-known Islamic anti-American terrorist, an individual who himself worked on behalf of U.S. intelligence in the Afghan War in the 1980s, and whose activities ranging from his alleged involvement in an ambush of United States Rangers in Somalia in 1993 to the bombing of a couple of U.S. embassies in August of 1998, as the impeachment proceedings were gathering steam, which led to strong criticism of Bill Clinton on the left, to the bombing of the USS Cole, a U.S. destroyer, also apparently bombed by bin Laden's forces. That bombing at the height of the election campaign in 2000 helped to make the Democrats, and by extension Al Gore, look weak on national security matters. This, in conjunction with rising petroleum prices, is, in the opinion of some, one of the factors that helped to put George W. Bush in a position to steal the presidency from Al Gore. I first discussed the book Fortunate Son in For the Record program number 186, actually in 182, and in For the Record program number 186, I speculated about the possibility that the information, the allegation of George W. Bush's cocaine conviction might have been deliberately fed to J.H. Hatfield because of knowledge of his criminal past, and then, once the book was out and once the discussions of George W. Bush's drug use had received a certain amount of publicity, then the criminal background of J.H. Hatfield was surfaced. This led to not only the discreditation of Hatfield, but by extension the discreditation of the information alleging that Bush had used drugs, and that in turn led to, in general, in my opinion anyway, an unwillingness on the part of the news media to examine George W. Bush's background critically. There has been information that has surfaced in the wake of J.H. Hatfield's death at the age of 43 of an alleged drug overdose. That discussed in For the Record program number 315, again, Not So Fortunate Son, recorded a few weeks ago. An article was published in Online Journal, a very fine online publication. This article was written by a fellow named Sander Hicks, who has a small alternative publishing house called Soft Skull Press. And Sander Hicks, after reading a copy of Fortunate Son and coming to the same conclusion that I had come to, which was that it was a well-researched and credible book, then republished Fortunate Son on behalf of Soft Skull Press. And according to Sander Hicks, the sources that were used by J.H. Hatfield for Bush's drug use and also that and other aspects of Bush's background were not only George Bush's minister, but also Karl Rove, a key Bush aide, who, according to Sander Hicks, apparently deliberately channeled some disinformation to J.H. Hatfield in order to discredit him, and may very well have been involved consciously with channeling the drug information to J.H. Hatfield, knowing that Hatfield himself could later be discredited because of his criminal background. Those are the allegations made in an article published in Online Journal by Sander Hicks, again, S-A-N-D-E-R as his first name, last name H-I-C-K-S. This is from Online Journal of May 23rd, 2001. You can access Online Journal at www.onlinejournal.com. And this article is titled by Online Journal, How Karl Rove Tricked the Media into Trashing the Messenger While Ignoring the Message. And after discussing the furor that arose in August of 2000, August of 1999, when George Bush, in an impromptu discussion, said that he had not used cocaine since 1974, that led a lot of people to say, there is discussion here of J.H. Hatfield's revealing his sources to Sander Hicks after Sander Hicks republished the book. Skipping down in the article, we read, I swore not to repeat it to anyone. This is Sander Hicks discussing his conversation with J.H. Hatfield. But I also knew that the truth is bigger than one person. We, that's Hatfield and Hicks, would both choose to reveal the sources publicly when the time was right, when we had no other choice, when we no longer had anything left to lose. The Eufaula connection, that's E-U-F-A-U-L-A, that was Carl T. Rove. The other top Bush advisor was Clay Johnson. The Bush confidant source was his minister, Mayfield. Now you know. Remember, you've got to swear now. Again, this was J.H. Hatfield making these allegations to Sander Hicks. And Hicks goes on to comment, J.H. Hatfield had just identified Carl T. Rove, the Bush campaign's senior advisor, to me personally as the primary source for the G.W. Bush cocaine arrest story. It took me that whole year to understand why Rove would do such a thing. When the media stumbled upon the story that George W. Bush was arrested for cocaine possession in 1972, it was through an anonymous tip reported by a columnist at Salon.com. Bush up to his A-blank-blank in allegations, sharp-toothed email, killer bees in bags of worms. Will this hound hunt? By Amy Reiter. That's the title of the Salon article. Hatfield's book was in final proofing stages when this hot story broke on August 25, 1999. The piece was the first to state that Bush had been arrested in the early 1970s and that he was, quote, ordered by a Texas judge to perform community service in exchange for expunging his record showing illicit drug use, unquote, according to the source. To make matters worse, that August, Bush went out on his own on the campaign trail and improvised on camera about his drug past. With his handlers out of town ghostwriting his autobiography, unquote, he blurted out at a press conference that he hadn't done drugs since 1974. The media crowed at the spectacle. For instance, USA Today gushed, "Bush has admitted something, but he refuses to say what," unquote. Hatfield, who had long suspected something was awry in young Bush's Playboy days, went back to his Texas sources to corroborate this story through Clay Johnson and Carl Rove, his regular sources of information. According to Hatfield, Rove and Johnson explained the cocaine arrest on the phone under condition of anonymity. Rove had earlier taken Hatfield on a fishing trip to Lake Eufaula, okay, to discuss Bush, so his pseudonym in the afterword became the cloak-and-dagger-esque The Eufaula Connection, unquote. Why choose Jim Hatfield? Hatfield had committed his 1987 crime in Dallas, where longtime Bush schoolmate and friend Clay Johnson was an associate. Johnson was friends with Hatfield's employers Larry Burke and Kay Burrow. He would have heard about the violent workplace conspiracy that stemmed from an illicit affair Burke was having with Burrow. Burrow had tried to blackmail Burke, and Hatfield took the fall for the attempt he arranged on Burrow's life at his boss Burke's request. Rove and Johnson further ensured that they could discredit Hatfield by feeding him flawed information. They altered key facts in the cocaine arrest story and thus raised the burden of proof for future reporters. At one point, Hatfield was told that the arresting judge was a Republican, a falsehood which, although easily detected, served to damage Hatfield's credibility. After St. Martin's rushed the cocaine arrest story into the book as an afterword, suddenly the Dallas Morning News received the private criminal record of J.H. Hatfield's felony in Texas. The news published an article about Hatfield's felonious past, and it was all over for the Bush cocaine arrest story. This style of disinformation follows the pattern set by all masters of public opinion of the 20th century. Carl T. Rove is an avid history buff and applies what he reads. In just 2 short months, he surgically removed the media's talk of the Bush drug arrest by feeding it to a biographer he knew had a felony conviction in his past. Hatfield broke the story, and then Rove broke Hatfield. The Bush campaign's friends at the Dallas Morning News broke a salacious, mesmerizing story about a car bomb, a hitman, a boss, a felony conviction, and the mass media's attention is focused en masse on Hatfield, who can't take the heat, denies the allegations, and flees town. St. Martin's doesn't know what's going on, but suddenly they are getting threatened by Bush campaign lawyers who are looking into, unquote, suing them. St. Martin's behavior becomes paranoid. They announce that they are pulling 88,000 copies of the book from stores. So much for America. So much for the Bill of Rights. And again, that by Sander Hicks, who is the publisher of and the owner of Soft Skull Press, which republished Fortunate Son in softcover. And I've discussed the information from Fortunate Son that the Texas business representative of the Bin Laden family put forth a portion of the venture capital to start up Arbusto Energy. And people who knew James R. Bath at the time, Bath part of the BCCI milieu, people who knew James R. Bath maintained that he had very little money of his own. And so the speculation has it that quite possibly the money that went to fund at least part of Arbusto Energy came from Bath's wealthy Saudi clients, and that would include the family of Osama bin Laden. I've discussed the Bush-Bath-Bin Laden connection in For the Record programs 182, number 186, number 248, number 256, number 277, and most recently in number 315. It would also appear that my intuition that quite possibly the information about the Bush, the allegation about the Bush cocaine involvement was deliberately channeled to someone who could be discredited appears to have substance under the circumstances. I've alluded to other programs that I've recorded. Those are available from a tape and CD duplication service called Spitfire. They can be reached at P.O. Box 1179, Ben Lomond, California, 95005. Email is mail@spitfirelist.com. And there will be an annotated description of this program in the For the Record section of the Spitfire website at spitfirelist.com. Sister station WFMU-FM is compiling the For the Record segments on Real Audio. More recent segments are streaming at WFMU.org/Dave Emery, one word. Older segments at archive.wfmu.org/archive/D#X/. That concludes For the Record program number 319, Bush League Part 3, being recorded on August 12th of 2001. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.